Nigerian students run for cover in Khartoum. Like millions of others, they've been trapped in the city for more than 2 weeks. The United Nations is warning Sudan is falling apart as the army and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, battle for control. There are shortages of food, water, fuel and medicine.
Honest to God, we work in difficult conditions. We opened the pharmacy despite the sound of gunfire for the sake of families and children. Our problem is how to get stock. The factories in the Bahri region were bombed.
The Interior Ministry has deployed extra police officers in Khartoum to stop looting. But what people really want is a permanent ceasefire. So far, several foreign mediated truces have barely held. These are soldiers near a bridge that connects Khartoum North to the city of Omdurman. Both are under heavy bombardment, as is the area around the presidential palace and army headquarters. The Rapid Support Forces says it's destroyed a convoy of 200 army vehicles near there in recent days. Every day, thousands of people decide it's no longer safe to stay. This rescue ship in Port Sudan is taking evacuees to Saudi Arabia. Around 5,000 Syrians say they're being processed more slowly than other nationalities.
We've been here for 8 days. The evacuation of Syrians has stopped. The day before yesterday, only 27 people were evacuated. No Syrians were evacuated yesterday. We do not know what is happening and no one gives us a clear answer.
In Arjin, on the Egypt-Sudan border, satellite images show queues of buses waiting to take people across. Others have flown home.
On the first 2 days of the war, there was action in Port Sudan with a couple of jets flying over and some bombs landing. But in Port Sudan itself, it was quiet. So obviously a lot of military action, but no fighting. But everyone's tense. But even the Sudanese people we work with wanted to go back to normal, because they just want their country to grow and prosper.
Former Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok has added his voice to those calling for an end to the conflict, warning it could deteriorate into one of the worst civil wars in the world. Victoria Gatenby, Al Jazeera.
Well, our correspondent Hiba Morgan joins us now live from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Hiba, there's only a few hours to go before the supposed ceasefire ends, but there have already been airstrikes. Has it actually made any difference?
Well, right now on the ground, both sides are claiming that they have the upper hand, while civilians say they've been caught up in the middle. In the city of Omdurman, for example, in the early hours of Sunday, there was heavy artillery strikes and airstrikes launched by both the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces on each other's positions. So people there say that, or at least in parts of Omdurman, say that they cannot see the ceasefire holding on the ground. Then there's the northern part of the capital, Bahri. Right now, there are plumes of smoke covering parts of the city of Bahri. Residents say that they have been hearing some shootings and some gunfire being exchanged between the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese army. But in other parts of the capital, they say that it's been relatively quiet, giving them the chance to be able to go out and buy food or other basic commodities. That's in the southern and eastern parts. But people are saying that there's the issue of cash. And they say that as long as the fighting continues, as long as the two sides continue to try to battle each other out to resolve their differences, they will be suffering.
Of course. And Hiba, as the fighting continues, are you hearing any word there of how mediation efforts are perhaps going?
Mediation efforts have not stopped since the start of the fighting on 15th of April. But the two sides seem to have conditions in regards to coming to a negotiating table and working out a deal or a ceasefire agreement. Now, the Sudanese Army General, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, spoke to a U.S. public broadcaster on Friday, and he says that to negotiate with the Rapid Support Forces, it has to include them being out of the military institution. Then you have the Rapid Support Forces saying that they will not negotiate unless there's a ceasefire in place. And all previous ceasefires has ended with accusations from both sides of violating it. The Sudanese army is saying that the RSF is trying to bring in more reinforcement to continue the battles in Khartoum, and that they were able to shoot down launch airstrikes on several of the RSF convoys. While the RSF is saying that it managed to imprison several army officers and soldiers in the city of Omdurman. So it looks like while all international bodies and regional bodies are trying to get the two sides to mediate or to reach some kind of deal to end the ceasefire for humanitarian aid to come in. Both sides want to make sure that they have the upper hand before they go to any negotiations to work out what's happening in Sudan.
Of course. Hibba Morgan there with all the latest for us from Khartoum. Thank you, Hibba. Well, let's bring in Khalid Hassan. He's the acting Sudanese ambassador to the UK. He joins us now from London. Khalid, we're into the third week of fighting now. How functional is the government at the moment in Khartoum? Are you getting regular updates?
Yeah, of course. I'm getting regular updates, and the government is working. Also, it's not in its full capacity because of this rebellion, but it's working.
So when you say working, so government departments are functioning, are there big holes in terms of being able to run a country?
You know, some of the civil servants just travel outside the Khartoum to celebrate Eid holidays, and they trap there because this rebellion has started and they couldn't come back to their normal life and normal works. But the government, some of the government's body are working, although the services for the people is very difficult, but they work very hard to provide it, like water, clean water.
Khalid, you referred... Sure, sorry, the line's not great. I just wanted to pick up on something you said there. You referred to this as being a rebellion. I want to talk about mediation. Our correspondent Hibba was just touching on that. You yourself, I believe, have praised Saudi efforts on brokering this latest ceasefire, which hasn't exactly held. But I believe you've also been a little more dubious about Western involvement.
Yeah, actually, we thank all our brotherly and friendly countries who call us and who offer to mediate in this situation in Sudan. We have IGAD initiatives that's leading by Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan, and Djibouti, and Indian president. That's the one now, I think, on the table. Have Saudi and U.S. Initiative mainly about ceasefire and humanitarian force.
Well, I want to also look at how we got here, because I think that's crucial as to how it potentially ends. You are currently acting ambassador to a country that was one of a quad of countries leading talks around the framework agreement, and that and a transition to civilian rule now feel very, very far away. But you think that the way that was handled is what caused this?
Yeah, one of the main causes of this conflict is the framework agreement, because it's isolated very important political players, and also the integration of the rebel support forces into the army. Those, I think, 2 points were the mainly points that created the problem now.
And so you think Western powers have essentially created the climate for this to take place?
I can't say that, but the framework agreement lead to this.
Sure. I know that you and your government have said that right now you're fighting to protect civilians, but there have already been huge deaths, huge displacement. The humanitarian situation is obviously rapidly deteriorating, not only in Khartoum, now across borders too. In your mind, how does this end?
Yeah, I agree. The humanitarian situation is very bad in Khartoum mainly. The other part of the country, life is normal, but Khartoum is very, very difficult for people to get enough food, medicine, clean water, electricity. But the government is trying to do best to end this rebellion and to return life back to normal as soon as possible. And we have seen yesterday that the police is on the ground and people start trying to get in their needs from the near shops. So gradually life is returning back to its normal.
So you say you're doing everything you can to help end the conflict. I want to ask you, though, as a member of General Burhan's government, what is your message, then, to the Rapid Support Forces?
As a message that they are Sudanese and they are taking their salaries from Sudan government, and they should put down their arms and join the Sudanese armed forces, and they will get amnesty as leader of the army and the president said before.
Khalid Hassan there, the acting Sudanese ambassador to the UK, speaking to us from London. Thank you for your time, sir. Thank you for joining us here on Al Jazeera. Well, Djibouti is one of the country's leading peace negotiations, and its foreign affairs minister says fighting isn't the solution.
All the observers are telling us that actually they want to finish the war on the military ground. One should prevail. That's the message we receive. But we cannot, as the region, accept that that happened, because we don't know when this victory of one party on the other will happen. And until then, the population in Khartoum, the people of Sudan, you know, is suffering.
Meanwhile, the World Food Programme is warning that the fighting in Sudan could plunge the entire East Africa region into a humanitarian crisis. It says a third of Sudan's population was starving even before the fighting broke out. Now there are shortages of food and prices are soaring. There have been similar price rises too in neighbouring South Sudan and Chad, which have taken in thousands of refugees. Well, our correspondent Ahmed Idris is in the border town of Adre in Chad with more.
People are still coming. One of the first camps set up by the international organisations like the United Nations, I had more than 4,000 refugees who have been registered formally, with hundreds more still looking in, trying to register themselves and their families in that particular camp. And yesterday, we moved to a different camp, which is Mazigilda. There, we found between 4,500 to 5,000 refugees in that particular camp. And we also understand, not far from where we are right now, some people have sort of moved their families, especially women and children, and are located in a village just close by here. Although there is no presence of aid organizations in that place, so we expect hundreds more are located in that community, and they are spread within families and also spread under trees and in the open spaces. Basically, the United Nations and other agencies who are trying to help these refugees are projecting to help at least 20,000 refugees in the past 1 week or so. But what we're seeing right now, the refugee numbers could go much, much higher than that. Already, the amount of food being delivered is not sufficient enough to last a family for 5 days. So what we're looking at, probably, unless food aid arrives, you will have significant issues here, health issues, malnutrition issues. Already, the United Nations Children's Fund is talking about dire situation for children.
Well, a large number of people from South Sudan are also trying to return home. Hari Mutasa is in the capital there, Juba.
The International Organization for Migration says there are about 1.5 million people from South Sudan living in Sudan. Some of them are refugees, others went there looking for work. When the fighting started, people like Anok Deng and her six children left Khartoum and came here to South Sudan's capital, Juba, a journey that took them about 2 days by bus. And they're now staying with family friends who've taken them in for as long as it takes. Anok Deng says the journey for her and her children to get here was traumatic.
My children heard gunfire and saw things they should never see. They are still scared. I am happy we got back to South Sudan safely.
No more killing in Sudan! No more killing in Sudan!
South Sudan has close ties with its neighbor, Sudan. Remember, this country gained independence from Sudan in 2011. Many people still have friends and family stuck in Sudan, and they're worried about what's happening over there.
The same experience that Sudan went is what I went through in our crisis in South Sudan, where we have witnessed people have been killed, people have lost lives, people have been displaced, and children and elderly people have suffered most. So when I so the fighting in Sudan, it worries me more, because I start wondering the pain that the Sudanese people are going through.
Salva Kiir, South Sudan's president, is leading mediation efforts as part of the regional group IGAD. He's trying to get officials from the Sudanese army and the paramilitary RSF to have face-to-face talks here in the capital, Juba. Government officials say it's still a work in progress. Khadra Mutasa, Al Jazeera, Juba.
Well, many people who had submitted their travel documents to foreign embassies are still stranded in Sudan. That's after Western diplomats fled the country. Rahila Mohammed has been taking a look at that for us.
Some Sudanese say they are trapped in Khartoum without their passports. Tens of thousands of people are fleeing to neighboring countries. Dozens of foreign governments have flown out their citizens and diplomatic staff. But for some Sudanese, leaving is not an option, as their travel documents are locked in shuttered embassies. Well, we spoke to Sudanese residents still stuck in the capital after failing to retrieve their passports.
By the end of March, I have applied for a study visa to South Africa. And by the date of 18th of April, after 3 days of war, starting most of diplomats and different embassies staff were evacuated. So I couldn't reach my passport, so I can't go anywhere. I didn't get any response from the embassy, no announcement, no phone calls, even no direct messages.
I applied for the Schengen visa at the Swedish embassy in Khartoum. I didn't get my passport back because the staff simply up and left with complete disregard to the situation. It's not just me, there are hundreds of us in different EU embassies. It's utterly irresponsible, and it's such a shame because they spent a lot of money on curbing the migration, the illegal migration, when they can't even come up with an e-visa system. So situations like this do not happen.
I emailed the Spanish embassy multiple times and I called them multiple times. But when they found out I was in Spanish, they hung up without any explanation. Me and my family were forced to leave our house in Khartoum as it was no longer safe. My family scattered. Me and my brother came to Port Sudan, but he got on the ferry to Jeddah. My mother and sister are currently in the Egyptian border trying to cross to Egypt. And I'm here not knowing what I will be doing next.
Well, as you can imagine, a lot of people are trying to figure out what's happening with their papers. Some are contacting governments on Twitter. The Dutch Foreign Ministry recently replied to a visa query confirming that a number of Sudanese passports had been left behind at the embassy. It advises people to apply for a new passport with local authorities. Another criticism of foreign governments is automated responses. Dozens of people are sharing their frustrations online as well. Now, some countries are trying to work around those changes on the ground. The Swiss embassy says it's working hard to find options for people to collect their passports. And the Chinese embassy says Sudanese residents can now collect their documents in Khartoum. Now, with so many people in limbo, you may be wondering, what are the legal implications? Sudan has signed a number of treaties, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It states everyone lawfully within the territory of a state shall, within that territory, have the right to liberty of movement. And everyone shall be free to leave any country, including his own. Rights groups say governments can be held liable for not doing enough to return passports to visa applicants.